ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife. News breakdown.
Well, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and his Papua New Guinea counterpart, James Marape, are literally doing the hard yards in the interest of bilateral relations. Right now, they are in the middle of the next 2 days hiking part of the Kokoda Track ahead of Anzac Day commemorations on Thursday. The PNG Prime Minister insisted that he couldn't let Anthony Albanese walk the track solo, and he said at a state dinner last night that he'll take a personal interest in our Prime Minister's welfare.
The next possibly 30 hours of our journey together in the mountains, or 36 hours, I choose to be your number one security guard. Your number one security guard. In every sense of the word.
Well, yes, there's lots of layers of meaning there, aren't they? Because now, notably, China's top diplomat, Foreign Minister Wang Yi, left Port Moresby's Jackson's International Airport just over 24 hours before Anthony Albanese touched down. So one out, one in, highlighting the interest now being shown by these foreign leaders in PNG and the Pacific region. Joining us tonight for Nightlife News Breakdown is a close observer of the diplomatic and military involvement in our near north. Peter Hatcher is political editor and international editor of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Peter, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
G'day, Phil. It's a pleasure.
Great to have you with us, too. Before we get to the niceties and perhaps tensions around who's got the most influence in PNG, let's look at the bigger picture. You've got a great piece in the SMH and The Age today talking about past failures of the US to react to the crossing of red lines. But you have noticed a change in US resolve now regarding Ukraine, the Middle East and Taiwan. Tell us about this lack of action in the Obama and Trump presidencies.
Well, Phil, you can trace a lot of the emboldening, I suppose, of dictators around the world to a particular moment when Barack Obama was president. You might remember the dictator of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, was gladly handing out the chlorine gas and the sarin gas to gas his own people to prevent an uprising. And Barack Obama said, well, that's enough, fella. You can't do that anymore. It's a war crime. And to use chemical weapons against your own people would be a red line. But then Bashar al-Assad went ahead and did it again anyway, and Obama did nothing, absolutely nothing. And dictators around the world looked at that and said the US has lost its strategic resolve. So it's no coincidence that the very next month, China, Xi Jinping, started to build artificial islands in the South China Sea, claiming maritime territories that were also claimed by Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia. And of course, that's still going on. And China has claimed huge swathes of the South China Sea, which is the world's single biggest commercial shipping thoroughfare. Most global trade goes through there, including almost all Australian exports. And then 7 months later, Vladimir Putin began his first assault on Ukraine by annexing Crimea and occupying the Donbass, and then later, of course, expanding it into a full-scale war when nobody really tried to stop him. So that was a vital moment. And Donald Trump was just as bad in indulging dictators. The US really, in those two presidencies, seemed to have lost its strategic resolve, lost its credibility, and dictators around the world started exploiting, and they haven't looked back. You've got not just Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin, but you've also got the Ayatollahs, Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran. You've got Kim Jong-un in North Korea. And they're all moving ahead with their aggressive expansion plans.
You might say Benjamin Netanyahu's no different. He's ignoring any entreaties from the US leadership, Joe Biden included, and doing what he wants.
Well, that is absolutely true. The difference there, of course, is that Israel is a US ally and is allowed more you'd expect an ally is allowed a little bit more indulgence. But you're right, he's pretty much ignored. It's near contempt with which he's treated most of Joe Biden's urgings and advice on how to proceed in Gaza. But you know, the thing that got me writing about this was the fact that this general lack of resolve out of Washington, the general sort of lassitude about being prepared to defend allies, it really seems to have turned around. And that now, you know, it's America. They're in having a bit of a bad run. Politics is slightly deranged. And so, you know, you can't make any long-term prognostications, but at least in the short run, the last few weeks, you could say maybe even months, the Biden administration has started to show some real spine. The Congress even cooperated on the weekend, and we saw a really remarkable bundling of massive volumes of financial and military assistance to go to three U.S. allies. Ukraine, $60 billion U.S. dollars, Congress voted for Ukraine. Another $20 billion plus for Israel, and another $8 billion for Indo-Pacific allies. That's mainly Taiwan. So for those three countries, they're three countries, allies of the U.S. under existential threat. They're all feeling vulnerable. And in that single act of the Congress, that's now a decisive contribution to their ability to stand against their allies. That was just one of the three examples I picked up. But, you know, it just shows that the U.S. can and sometimes will really flex its muscle and stand for its allies. And that's got to be a good thing for any U.S. ally, including a little country called Australia, Phil. Mm.
Yes, it's all very well to mark out red lines, isn't it? But if people call your bluff, as has happened in the past, as you rightly observe, you have to be prepared to do something. And in the case of the US, what that is, you know, is not entirely clear, because at all times, strategically, I think the US has concluded that if it reacts with anything other than moderate timidity, it's going to be catastrophic. For example, in Ukraine, what were they supposed to do? Launch an air war against Russia, for example.
Well, that's right. They didn't. I mean, so there are two things. The Americans, as we know and love them, have veered between excessive militaristic bombast and violence on the one hand.
Look at Afghanistan and look at Iraq, yeah.
Exactly. Iraq in particular was just a made-up war. It was a shocking war with disastrous consequences. And on the other hand, excessive timidity, and they seem to have trouble getting it right with you know, prudent deployment of force where necessary. And yet in Ukraine, they've pretty much, in my view, they've pretty much got the sweet spot. They've refused to directly engage. I mean, you know, Ukraine is not a member of NATO. It's not a treaty ally of the US. The US is under no obligation to defend it. And the US doesn't want to get involved in a shooting war with Russia, both nuclear armed, but it has done the next best thing, which is to give massive support to Ukraine. So the Europeans, to give you the Ukrainians the tools to defend their country, and without that U.S. contribution, Ukraine would have fallen. And the U.S. has been not only with the money, but also intelligence and armaments and all the rest of it as well, has been essential to Ukraine preserving its sovereignty.
Although it may still fall. I mean, there's an entirely reasonable view advanced that Ukraine has probably lost the war in any meaningful sense, in the sense that they're going to expel the Russians from their territory. That's not going to happen.
Remember,
The question is, what's the objective here? Because Ukraine may have already lost the war, may they?
Well, they haven't yet. But if the Americans had stood by and not provided, including this last package, this rather large package that they voted for on the weekend, then yes, Ukraine would be losing. It would now be considering its negotiating options, but just kept it in the war.
Mm. All right, look, to the PNG visit, Anthony Albanese's visit to Papua New Guinea, more than just a reminder of the two nations' shared sacrifice in World War II. There's a bit at stake here, isn't there? I mean, the Chinese are actively inserting themselves and wanting influence in PNG and indeed other areas of the Pacific. They're handing out money. the PNG government have taken it in some respect. Well, you know, why shouldn't they? PNG Prime Minister said having such a high-ranking Chinese visitor as the foreign minister, then Australian visitors, meant PNG was blessed. Its geography is a blessing at the moment, perhaps, isn't it?
Absolutely. And for the same reason, it was getting a lot of attention in World War II, Phil, and that is that the geography of the world obviously hasn't changed. So when a country, in the case of World War II, is Imperial Japan today, the People's Republic of China, decides that it would like the option of subduing Australia in a crisis, then Papua New Guinea, Solomons, to the immediate north of Australia, is a very important bit of real estate, because the strategic intention of the Chinese, and this is the judgment of the Australian government, the US and others, is to do the same thing that the Japanese were trying to do in World War II, and that is you can cut Australia. You know, Australia's a very large and difficult and expensive country to invade and occupy. So why would you, when it's much easier, simpler and cheaper to subdue Australia by cutting us off? And that is using bases which the Japanese built in the Solomons and in PNG, using military bases there to cut off Australia's sea lines of communication, effectively shipping to connect us to the world. We can't export and we can't import essential goods. And we're effectively out of the war. We're effectively subdued and neutralized. And in the case of World War II, the Japanese also, the intention was to deprive the US of access to Australia so it couldn't use Australia as a base. And the Chinese in this century are thinking along exactly the same line. So, yeah, Papua New Guinea, Solomons, all these countries are suddenly of vital interest. And Australia, which pretty, you know, you won't hear Albanese saying this, but pretty shamefully neglected PNG for decades, we're finally paying it the attention it deserves, only because the Chinese are competing for their attention.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. All right. The Chinese are also building port facilities in Nauru, somewhat funded by Australia, apparently, through the Asian Development Bank. Now, Lord forbid, if there was a conflict in the region with the Chinese not on our side, is Nauru then a useful port for Chinese warships, do you think?
Yes, absolutely. Basically, anything that brings the ability of the People's Liberation Army Navy closer to interdicting Australian shipping is a strategic asset in the event of a crisis. So at the moment, the nearest Chinese military base to Australia is more than 6,000 kilometres away. But if you can pop a bit of a base into the Solomons or Nauru, you're cutting that to under 2,000 or so kilometres. So that brings Australia much more closely in range. So, yes, you do have to wonder why Australia is paying a quarter, $20 million of the $80 million cost of building that refurbished port in Nauru, if in fact it's going to end up, it's being built, in fact, by a Chinese company.
It's being built by a Chinese company, yeah. Yep, indeed. You're right to point to these strategic issues. Look, can we shift gear to domestic policy and negative gearing? We've been discussing the housing crisis in our first hour of the program tonight. Two of the Senate's most influential crossbenchers, Tasmania's Jackie Lambie and the ACT's David Pocock, have joined forces to demand the federal government rein in generous tax concessions for property investors. Following the 2019 election disaster for the ALP, of course, the Labor government's very reluctant, indeed totally gun-shy, about touching negative gearing. It's repeatedly ruled out any changes to negative gearing, but changes to the negative gearing and capital gains tax discount schemes might save billions of dollars for the budget bottom line, might actually assist those on lower incomes to get into the market by precluding some investors. Now, the pair of senators have modelled five different changes to the existing arrangements, with all of their proposals grandfathered to ensure they don't affect existing property investors. This is David Pocock, the independent senator from the ACT.
This isn't the silver bullet, but this is one really important lever to one, start to change the way that people invest, but two, save, you know, $16 to $60 billion over the next decade, which could be invested in social and affordable housing.
Well, it's hard to argue with. Jackie Lambie also was weighing in.
Why are we giving so much tax out to people, tax relief out to people with these houses? This is getting past the point of ridiculous. This is just privileged positions, and I think we've all had more than enough of it.
Well, we may have had more than enough of it. Whether Labor or anybody else is going to fiddle with negative gearing is quite another matter after having their fingers so badly burnt. Do you think, Peter?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, 2019... people of Australia were asked, have you had enough of it? And they said, no, we haven't. Give us some more. And if you dare touch it, we'll hit you and hit you hard. And that's what happened to Bill Shorten. He lost that election, not only because of these policies. He, as a leader, as a his persona was judged by the people to be untrustworthy. So that never helps a guy wanting to be prime minister. But the policy ideas that he brought to that election, including curbing negative gearing and capital gains tax discounts for rental property. And by the way, the pre-existing benefits would have been grandfathered by the Shorten proposal as well, so that's not a new idea, were used by the Liberal Party to run a very effective scare campaign. The public said, no, don't you dare touch our tax concessions. The rest is history. Shorten lost. There's no way any government is going to attempt to do that again, whether it's Labor or Liberal. So these two senators, they're well-meaning. There is some sense in what they say. But, crossbenchers only have influence when the major parties are prepared to act. And the major parties simply aren't. So they're really crying, into the wind.
Yes, despite the fact that they may well have reason and equity on arguments on their side. Peter Harcher, always great to talk. Appreciate it. Thank you for your time.
Pleasure, Phil. Happy to.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.